KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump keeps raising tariffs that Americans pay to import goods from China. China just raised its tariffs again. So what are the workarounds for business? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Republicans in Congress have mostly stayed out of the trade war. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Some Senate Republicans did call for Congress to take back the tariff power. Indiana's Todd Young says lawmakers should do their job. The Trump administration cancels grants issued by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And in today's installment of the State of the First Amendment, a look at what's happening to academic freedom on college campuses. It is Friday, April 11th. On this day in 1980, the EEOC published guidelines saying that sexual harassment in the workplace is unlawful sex discrimination. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Stocks opened mixed this morning after a better-than-expected report on wholesale inflation. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average was down about a point in early trading.
Wholesale prices fell by 0.4% last month, echoing Thursday's good news about cooling inflation at the retail level. That progress on prices could be stalled, however, by President Trump's trade war. China says it's raising its own tariffs on U.S. exports to 125%. Authorities say that's as high as China's likely to go. Tariffs at that level put a halt to most trading, so any additional taxes have little effect. J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon's warning of considerable turbulence ahead for the economy and says the bank is setting aside more money to cover possible loan defaults. The bank also says Chase credit card holders are cutting back on travel spending and stockpiling goods in an effort to avoid tariffs. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
While President Trump has put a temporary pause on some tariffs, many others remain in place. That includes a 25% tariff on imported cars that kicked in last week. But cars that are on the lots right now are not affected by the tariffs. NPR's Camilla Domonoske explains that leaves would-be car buyers with a choice.
Last month was the best month for new car sales in 4 years. Cars already on dealer lots aren't affected by tariffs. That's a few months' supply, and in fact, some companies are offering deals. Kira Ney was planning to get a car next year.
But with the tariffs and so much of the uncertainty about that, we just decided that we couldn't wait any longer.
She says the dealership was packed when she and her husband bought their new SUV. Of course, if prices go up, as expected in the coming months, sales will slow. And while new car prices aren't up yet, used car prices are already starting to rise. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
The U.S. Supreme Court says the Trump administration must, quote, facilitate the return of an immigrant wrongly deported to El Salvador. But the court sent the case of Kumar Abrego Garcia back to the lower court trial judge. Justice has said the lower court judge needs to clarify her meaning. She had ordered the Trump administration to, quote, effectuate the man's return. NPR's Joel Rose says the judge responded to the high court's direction immediately.
Judge Polizzini has issued a new revised order clarifying that the government needs to take, quote, all steps to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia, unquote, to the U.S. as soon as possible. Zinis wants to know his current physical location and status, what steps the government has taken to bring him back, and what additional steps they are considering. And she's called a hearing for later today in Maryland. So Judge Zinis is not wasting any time.
NPR's Joel Rose reporting. The Justice Department is trying to delay today's hearing until next week. On Wall Street, the Dow is now down about 60 points. This is NPR. New York City authorities say six people were killed yesterday when a sightseeing helicopter crashed into the Hudson River. Five members of a family from Spain died, along with the aircraft pilot. A passerby filmed the helicopter tumbling out of the sky, apparently without one of its rotor blades. A hurricane recovery effort in western North Carolina is among some of the programs halted by the Trump administration's latest cuts, NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
Plans to survey Buncombe County residents affected by Hurricane Helene were scrapped last Tuesday. Workers at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention coordinating it were fired. And state and local officials couldn't find out whether residents still struggle to access health care or clean water, for example. Zach Moore is an epidemiologist with North Carolina's health department.
Beyond hurricanes, they do radiation preparedness, toxicology issues, surveillance for illnesses in Red Cross shelters after a disaster. So having them instantly disbanded is going to leave a big gap.
He says it's just one example of how federal agency cuts will affect local communities. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Scientists say there will be a micro moon this weekend. It will be the smallest, farthest, and faintest full moon spied so far this year. It will rise Saturday night. Having trouble seeing it clearly? You can view it online at the Virtual Telescope Project. They'll be able to zoom in. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at AmazonBusiness.com. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Coming up, a Republican senator tries for a thoughtful focus on China, and he urges the president to clarify just what his plan is.
But first, stocks opened lower this morning after China said it's raising its own tariffs on U.S. exports to 125%. It was a response to one of President Trump's many changes to the tariff rates on Chinese goods.
This week, the president made up a new tax rate that Americans pay for Chinese imports. He made the announcement by composing a social media post with a couple of cabinet secretaries in the room. That was the process. One day later, the White House said the rate was actually different than announced, marking the sixth time the president has changed the China tariff in a matter of weeks. So what does all this mean for financial markets and the broader economy?
NPR's Scott Horsley has been watching all these ups and downs, and he is with us now. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning. More downs than ups lately.
Well, you sure got that right. So the stock market regained a lot of its earlier losses on Wednesday when Trump backtracked on some of its tariffs. But then the air went out of the balloon pretty fast. What happened?
Yeah, math happened. Analysts crunched the numbers yesterday and figured out that even with Wednesday's rollback, we're still looking at the highest import taxes in well over a century. There's now a 10% tax on everything the U.S. buys from most countries around the world, and the tax on imports from China is even higher than we thought, 145%. Now, overnight, China punched back with its own triple-digit tariff on U.S. exports, and investors are worried this could really be a drag on economic growth. Speaking at the Economic Club in New York yesterday, Austin Goolsbee used a technical term to describe all this. He called it the freak-out channel. Goolsbee is president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago.
The market is kind of like, ah, and the consumer's like, ah, and the Fed's job in that environment is to be the one to say, please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until the pilot indicates it is time to move about the cabin.
President Trump's been lobbying the Fed to cut interest rates, but Goolsbee says the central bank's going to take its time. He notes that before this trade war took off last week, the U.S. was actually in solid economic shape with low unemployment and falling inflation.
Yeah, and there was some good news on inflation yesterday, but that was largely drowned out by the tariff talk. Would you say more about that?
Yeah, yesterday's report from the Labor Department showed inflation seemed to be coming under control last month. Prices in March were up only 2.4% from a year ago. Prices actually came down a little bit between February and March, thanks to a sharp drop in gas prices. Now, I should note grocery prices, which are something that the president likes to talk a lot about, were up in March, and retail egg prices continue to climb. Egg farmers have gotten a little bit of a break in recent weeks from avian flu after a really tough winter. But it's going to take months to rebuild the egg-laying flock. And in the meantime, egg prices are up about 60% from a year ago, with Easter just around the corner.
And there is concern that progress on inflation could be stalled by the trade war. Isn't that right?
Sure, especially with tariffs, you know, that could more than now double the price on stuff we buy from China, like clothing and furniture and electronics and toys. Up until Wednesday, the president's tariff gun was sort of pointed in every direction. Now it is aimed more directly at China. And that does mean there's more opportunity for importers to lower their tariff bill by shopping in countries other than China. But even if that happens, we're still looking at the highest tariff since the Great Depression in the 1930s. And Austin Goolsbee says that could put the Fed in a tough spot as it tries to decide what to do with interest rates.
If you start to see a recession coming, you should lower the rates. If you see prices rising and the inflation rate going up, you should raise the rates. If there's a lot of uncertainty, you should wait and do nothing.
Right now, markets are betting the Fed will stick with that do-nothing approach and hold interest rates steady, at least for the next couple of months.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
So far, Congress has largely left the trade war to the president. Although only Congress is supposed to raise taxes, such as tariffs, the president has claimed emergency authorities to do that again and again. House Republican leaders have blocked efforts to force a vote on his actions. Some Republican senators have been more involved. Indiana's Todd Young says he wants Trump to clarify what he's doing.
And I've encouraged the administration to do that. Most importantly, just providing a more specific plan about how all of this ends, what the negotiating objectives are.
Todd Young is one of seven Senate Republicans who signed onto a bill with Democrats that would reclaim Congress's authority over tariffs. In a low-key style, he's been pressing the administration, even though he agrees broadly with strengthening the U.S. position against China. Young came on the line for a discussion that ranged well beyond the tariffs that President Trump increased this week.
I'm a U.S. Marine. I attended the U.S. Naval Academy. I care a lot about national security issues, and I perceive that most of the national security issues we're facing today is coming down to issues of innovation and techno-economic competition.
Todd Young once sponsored parts of the CHIPS and Science Act. That law aims to boost U.S. computer chip manufacturing, partly to secure it from China. Young also leads a commission that just this week issued a warning about China's growing power in biotechnology. That means advanced medical research, genetic research, new kinds of weapons, and more.
I come from the state of Indiana, so I've always had some understanding of the biopharmaceutical industry and our ability to create life-improving, life-extending, life-enhancing drugs. And
oh, sure. Eli Lilly is in Indianapolis. Sure.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, of course, we have a very robust agricultural sector, and so ag bioscience is really critical to our productivity and our ability to sustain not just our own people, but also people in far-off countries.
As with artificial intelligence, it is sometimes hard to articulate how biotech advances might be used. They could lead to new treatments for disease or to new products like shelf-stable blood that soldiers could use in emergencies.
They can literally grow it, and it's something they could put in their backpack. So we don't want the Chinese or other adversaries in a time of conflict to have access to these tools, and our warfighters not to have access.
Years ago, the Chinese put out an industrial strategy called Made in China 2025, and they named a bunch of industries they wanted to dominate, and biotech was one. Made in China 2025, here it is 2025. Do they dominate in that area that concerns you?
This has been sobering. Yes, they are leading. dominance is not the characterization I would use, but they are leading in some key areas of biotechnology. They have outflanked the United States when it comes to biomanufacturing in particular. We need to right the course.
He says American pharmaceutical companies depend on China for many of the active ingredients in their medications.
So to the extent they are able to threaten to withhold these inputs into our manufacturing economy, that undermines our health security, and it could conceivably undermine our national security if we were in a time of conflict. So I know that's why President Trump is determined to reorder our trade relations with China so that we can become more resilient and avoid these things in the future.
As Senator Young spoke yesterday about the long-term challenge of China, more immediate issues demanded attention. The stock market was sliding again as the reality of the trade war became clear. On Wednesday, the president backed away from the highest tariffs on much of the world, but kept a global 10% tariff in place and raised taxes on Chinese goods to 125%. And then on Thursday, the president clarified the math and decided the tariffs are 145%. Which led to a question for Senator Young. Jason Furman, who's a well-known economist, was in the Obama administration, argues that this is actually more pressure on the U.S. economy than the president's original plan because the tariffs on China are so high and China is so critical to the U.S. economy. Is that right?
Well, listen, I haven't seen the Furman analysis. It's the first time I've heard his statement. But what I would say is that no other leader, certainly in modern history, has decided to right the wrongs of some unfair trade relations. So many of my constituents want credit to be given where credit is due, and I think fairly. They want us to acknowledge that the president should have an opportunity to renegotiate some of these rates. If what Mr. Furman is saying is that this is an exercise that is not worthwhile, I think we need to give it some time to play out as long as there's clarity brought to what the plan is.
I think he's just warning there's a lot of economic risk for the United States right now.
Yeah, you know, there is certainly risk, but there's also great risk to the United States of America if we're so reliant on critical nodes in our supply chains and critical inputs that we might be starved of those inputs when we need them. That's called economic coercion. And no one else has really tackled these things in the past. It is time we tackle them. What I've been pushing for is more clarity so that our investors and businesses know when they can deploy capital and what return on investments they can project and all the rest of it.
You were one of seven senators last week to co-sponsor a bill that would cause Congress to reclaim some of the emergency tariff powers to make it much harder for the president to act as a single individual and raise and lower taxes every day without Congress. Why does it matter who does this?
Well, it matters because I have a job to do, and that job is laid out both in precedent and also formally, you know, in our Constitution. And so my job when it comes to revenue measures should be to have a say on behalf of my constituents when it comes to tax policy and tariff policy. What we have seen in modern history is members of Congress, candidly, it seems to me they didn't want to make really hard decisions. So they've delegated those hard decisions to successive presidents. This president is not to be faulted for using the powers that Congress has delegated to him. But I think my constituents are now, as they ask for more clarity, as they ask for me to represent their interests, they want Congress to right the balance.
When you talk about that need for clarity and the uncertainty that still hangs over the economy, is your bill actually the only answer to that? As long as one person can raise and lower taxes on the whole economy any given day or any given hour, there's going to be uncertainty. The only way to have certainty is for Congress to be passing laws.
Well, you're not going to hear any argument from me that Congress needs to do its job. You know, it's time for all of the branches of government to do work, not just to be social media influencers and communicators, but instead to legislate. And so that's our charge.
Senator Todd Young, thanks for the time. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Steve.
This is NPR News.
The hit series Hacks is back on HBO and Max. It follows the sharp, funny, and sometimes tense dynamic between an aging stand-up legend and a young comedy writer. On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk with stars Jean Smart and Hannah Einbinder, as well as Paul W. Downs, who co-created, co-wrote, and stars in the show. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Cunard, sailing to destinations worldwide on Queen Mary II, Queen Victoria, Queen Elizabeth, and Queen Anne, with the goals of relaxation, indulgence, and adventure. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Workday, Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people and money today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. From Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. All over the country, organizations are scrambling to cover costs that they thought would be paid by federal grants approved by the National Endowment for the Humanities, but then were abruptly canceled by the Trump administration. So you might wonder, what does the NEH do anyway? NPR's Elizabeth Blair has some answers.
Humanities is a big word that is deceptively simple. It's all about what it means to be human. So things like language, religion, history, art, and community.
The humanities help us understand who we are, where we come from, and what we value.
Lauren Tilton is a professor of digital humanities at the University of Richmond. She oversees a project that received nearly $500,000 from the NEH. She's working with 14 other colleges throughout the Southeast to study the social and human impact of AI.
Because AI is affecting all parts of our lives, a big question is, how do we want to design AI? What do we want it to do? What do we not want it to do? And how does it impact people and communities?
After working on it for 2 years, they were expecting to launch the Center for Liberal Arts and AI this fall. Then, last week, Tilton got the letter saying their grant was terminated.
It was incredibly painful to read it.
The letter said, in part, that the federal agency was redirecting funds in, quote, furtherance of President Trump's agenda. But Tilton thinks their work is part of his agenda. She points to an executive order to maintain America's global dominance in AI.
And so here we are doing the AI work that is supposed to be a major area of innovation in our nation. And then we receive a letter attempting to defund years of work to be a part of that goal.
Tilton says they're now looking for private philanthropy. Neither the NEH nor the White House responded to requests for comment. Filmmaker Yuriko Romer's grant was also terminated.
I was originally awarded $600,000 for my documentary, and the remaining balance sits at $342,598.
Romer says she's on the home stretch of a documentary tracing 150 years of U.S.-Japan relations through the lens of baseball.
It's also about an amazing friendship and a bridge that has been built between those two countries, and it's an important ally.
This is from the trailer for Diamond Diplomacy.
In the United States, baseball was touted as the national game, and Japan also thought of baseball as its national game.
National Endowment for the Humanities grants, like the one Romer received, are competitive.
It was a huge honor to be awarded a National Endowment for Humanities grant last year. And now for this to happen is just heartbreaking.
Romer says she has a crew of about 14 people she still needs to pay. Her documentary has been selected for a screening at the National Baseball Hall of Fame at the end of May.
Whatever form it's going to be in at that time will screen, but I'm going to have to cobble together some more funding at this point. So that it's very disappointing.
Yuriko Romer says she and the other documentary filmmakers she knows who receive NEH grants aren't getting rich doing it. They're just passionate about telling American stories. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
It's Friday, which is when we hear from StoryCorps. And this morning we rebroadcast some gentle voices from 2016. Francois Clemens played Officer Clemens on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for 25 years. He was the first African-American actor to have a recurring role on a kids' TV series. Clemens recalled joining the cast in 1968 after Fred Rogers heard him sing in church.
Fred came to me and said, "I have this idea. You could be a police officer." That kind of stopped me in my tracks. I did not have a positive opinion of police officers. Policemen were sicking dogs and water hoses on people. And I really had a hard time putting myself in that role. So I was not excited about being Officer Clemens at all. But there was one particular scene that Fred and I did where he had his feet resting in this plastic pool on a hot day.
Oh, there's Officer Clemens. Hi, Officer Clemens, come in.
Rogers, how are you?
And he invited me to come over and to rest my feet in the water with him.
Would you like to join me?
Okay,
sure.
The icon Fred Rogers not only was showing my brown skin in the tub with his white skin as two friends, but as I was getting out of that tub, he was helping me dry my feet.
There, that one's dry. Thank you.
And so that scene touched me in a way that I was not prepared.
Sometimes just a minute like this will really make a difference.
I think he was making a very strong statement. That was his way. I still was not convinced that Officer Clemens could have a positive influence in the neighborhood and in the real world neighborhood, but I think I was proven wrong.
You were on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood for a long time.
Yeah. I discovered a friend for life. I'll never forget one day I was watching him film a session, and you know how at the end of the program, he takes his sneakers off, he hangs up his sweater, and he says, "You make every day a special day just by being you, and I like you just the way you are." I was looking at him when he was saying that, and he walks over to where I was standing, and I said, "Fred, were you talking to me?" And he said, "Yes, I have been talking to you for years, but you heard me today." It was like telling me I'm okay as a human being. That was one of the most meaningful experiences I'd ever had.
I'm so proud of you, Francois.
Oh, thank you, Fred.
Do you have time to give a song to my friend and me?
I sure do. There are many ways to say I love you. There are many ways to say I care about you.
All right, Francois Clemens with Carl Lindholm in 2016. Their interview is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial. Pre-planning a celebration of life can allow more time to focus on life's little moments. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com. And from Subaru, in partnership with the Arbor Day Foundation, Subaru is distributing over 100,000 trees this year to grow greener, healthier communities for generations to come. Subaru, more than a car company.
There are many ways to say I love you. There are many ways.
It's NPR News.
Are you a cat person or a dog person? Well, whatever your preference, the new documentary Pets explores what our relationship with animals says about being human.
There's a side of people that come out when they're talking about their pets that's very revealing.
I'm Juana Summers. My conversation with actress and documentary filmmaker Bryce Dallas Howard on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Republican-led House has narrowly passed a budget resolution that advances large parts of President Trump's domestic policy agenda. NPR's Deidre Walsh reports that House Speaker Mike Johnson says the real work begins now.
He and Senate Majority Leader John Thune met separately with a group of about 20 conservatives who were adamant that the budget package had to include a minimum amount of spending cuts. They're talking $1.5 trillion. There's a range in this resolution, but these hardliners weren't convinced the Senate would actually meet the higher number, and now they say they are.
That's NPR's Deidre Walsh reporting. Rising tariffs are weighing on small business owners across the nation. Michelle Lomeline is the owner of Sweet Petite Confections in San Diego. She says her costs have been going up for a while, especially for chocolate.
I have bonbons that are $3 a bonbon, and my competitors are all $4, $4.50. $5 a bonbon. I'm going to go up to maybe $3.75. You know, your customers are also shocked when they see the prices go up.
Many small business owners are feeling the squeeze, especially those who manufacture their products in China. Stocks are trading lower at this hour on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 247 points. The Nasdaq Composite down 95. The S&P 500 down 33. This is NPR. Pharmaceutical pollution is increasingly contaminating rivers and streams around the world. As NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports, new research suggests this pollution can alter salmon migration.
In the lab, giving fish anti-anxiety medication makes them more antisocial and prone to take risks. But scientists haven't been sure whether wild fish respond in the same way. New research in the journal Science suggests that they can. Atlantic salmon exposed to anxiety medication on a migratory journey were actually more successful in reaching their destination. Researchers say the meds could be making the fish more bold when crossing dams, a change in behavior that likely would cause problems in other contexts. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
The Food and Drug Administration has reinstated its work-from-home policy for some employees. The decision reverses a rule that required the agency's workforce to return to the office on a full-time basis. The shift is in response to significant operational disruptions, including staff resignations and layoffs. Under the new directive, drug reviewers and supervisors will be allowed to work from home at least 2 days per week. Stocks continue to trade lower on Wall Street. The Dow is now down 182 points, the Nasdaq down 69, the S&P down 23. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Leila Fadel. The Trump administration is threatening hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funding for schools like Cornell, Harvard, Northwestern, after accusations like this one from President Trump back when he was preparing to run for office again.
We spend more money on higher education than any other country, and yet they're turning our students into communists and terrorists and sympathizers of many, many different dimensions.
The administration is investigating dozens of universities for programs that support minorities and for alleged failures to stop anti-Semitism on campuses. And it's trying to deport international students, almost all of whom were involved in pro-Palestinian protests or advocacy. Taken together, the question is the administration moving to protect Jewish students' right to study, or is it using the pretext of discrimination to bully the nation's top universities into compliance? Today, in our morning edition series, The State of the First Amendment, the right from which all rights flow, is academic freedom on university campuses fading? So what does it feel like on college campuses these days for students and professors? Well, it kind of depends on what you believe and how you express that publicly.
This is Martin here. I'm 19 years old right now. I go to UC Berkeley.
My name's Miguel. I'm also at the University of California, Berkeley.
These two say Berkeley, known as a liberal campus, hasn't always felt that welcoming to Trump supporters like them. Martin Berteo and Miguel Muniz are the incoming and outgoing presidents of the College Republicans on campus. Here's Miguel.
At times it means you don't get representation from the school. It means that the school doesn't put out rhetoric defending you, your beliefs, or your own safety. It means that it's going to be difficult to have friends sometimes.
A UC Berkeley spokesperson says this just isn't true, that they defend all student perspectives. And Muniz and Berteo say things do feel different for them on campus and among their peers with President Trump back in office.
College Republican chapters in California, no, across the country, are seeing, really record growth right now.
Certainly a few of our students individually are more comfortable, I guess, publicly outing themselves.
Now, they say it's not a sea change. People still curse at them, they say, or spit on them when they're handing out flyers on campus. They say what's protected their ability as a student organization to bring speakers and hold events at this public university is the First Amendment.
The main thing that's allowed us to be free in our speech is the legal action that the university knows that we will take if we're not treated fairly.
Even those who don't identify as conservatives have worried about being shunned for certain beliefs. Nicholas, a West Virginia-based professor, describes himself as generally progressive. He's only going by his first name because he worries about blowback over his views. And Nicholas is a gun owner and...
Although I'm fully supportive of transgender rights, I do think that there's a difference that needs to be considered more carefully when it comes to sports, for example.
He works on a progressive campus and runs in progressive circles. So for years, he'd kept these beliefs quiet.
Like, I didn't think I would be fired, but, you know, did I think I would lose friends or be diminished in some way in the eyes of colleagues? Yes. And I was concerned that there could be lost opportunities.
He's not sure if it's because of the election, but recently he's felt freer to tell friends and colleagues what he really thinks. Nicholas says his fear, though, of being shunned over a belief or two he holds is different than...
someone, for example, exercising free speech, their right to protest someone here legally, then being arrested. That's more of a very literal policing function, and we are very much in frightening territory.
He's referring to all the visa revocations, detentions, and planned deportations of international students on college campuses. There are also those threats to funding over accusations of alleged rampant anti-Semitism on campuses, or that universities are running racially exclusionary programs, programs that support Black, Latino, and Native American students. Ibram X. Kendi is a historian of race and racism, an area of study that's been a particular focus of the administration's wrath.
I don't imagine there being free speech, currently, because free speech isn't just the ability to speak freely and share your opinions. It's also the confidence that you're not going to be targeted.
The only way to protect free speech on campuses, he says, is unity among academics and university leaders.
No matter what we study, we should all collectively be seeking to defend us all, so that we can continue to produce scholarship based on our expertise.
Is academic freedom under threat, or is it being corrected as the administration looks at it?
If anything, this administration is trying to eliminate academic freedom. And frankly, the first order of business is convincing and threatening professors and administrators and students to essentially shackle themselves to not speak out, to not research particular issues, to not use even words that they think this administration will have issue with. And I think that's what makes it incredibly chilling in this moment.
I asked Kendi about the administration's allegations that diversity, equity, and inclusion programs are used as a tool to divide rather than unite Americans of different races, that opponents to DEI charge that these programs prioritize diversity over merit. And he says he sees this as a dangerous trope now coming from the government.
It came from white supremacist thought. One of their most important talking points was this notion that diversity or anti-racism or equity work wasn't about bringing people together, wasn't about creating a level playing field, that somehow it was about harming white people, even seeking to carry out a genocide of white people. And unfortunately, that white supremacist talking point went mainstream, and people largely don't know the origins of that talking point.
How is academic freedom important and connected to freedom of speech?
Academic freedom is the child of free speech. We need to freely study the problems of society, to be able to come up with evidence-based solutions that can be presented to elected officials that can actually help humanity. And instead, we'll have elected officials creating solutions that satiate constituents and tell them this solution is going to help them when in fact it ultimately harms them.
That was Ibram X. Kendi, an American author, professor, and historian of race, on the status of free speech on college campuses. You also heard from a West Virginia professor named Nicholas and two college Republicans at UC Berkeley, Miguel Muniz and Martin Berteo. Monday, in our morning edition series, The State of the First Amendment, we look at how scientists and researchers are more free in some senses and less in others.
There's so much distrust amongst the people in charge and the scientists and also the public that now the entire scientific community is getting punished.
Are scientists free to pursue the facts? This is NPR News.
Researchers from a private biosciences company say they've extracted DNA from a 13,000-year-old fossil to bring the dire wolf back to life. Next time on Here and Now.
With everything from groceries to orthodontics, yes, really, available on demand, why not public radio? Make playing NPR or this station part of your smart speaker routine to stay informed on your schedule.
Good morning, I'm Michelle Martin. 34-year-old Evan Beck is an analyst at an investment firm in Washington, D.C., but this weekend, he's going head-to-head against the best golfers on the planet. Beck is one of five amateur golfers competing at the Masters Tournament, where stars like Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, and Arnold Palmer built their legacies. Beck's a long shot. No amateur has ever won this event, but if the impossible happens, that green jacket would sure look great on the back of his office chair. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station
And from your part-time controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Most Catholics and evangelicals backed President Trump on Election Day. Now a report indicates Trump's promise to carry out the largest deportation in U.S. history places millions of Christians at risk. Jack Jenkins of Religion News Service reports.
1 in 12 Christians in the U.S. could be affected by President Trump's plan for mass deportation, either by being deported themselves or witnessing a family member's deportation. That means as many as 10 million Christians are vulnerable to deportation, with an additional 7 million living with family members who are at risk of being removed from the United States. Those are the key findings from a new report issued by Catholic bishops and evangelical Christian leaders. They insist they're not taking a political position, but want to sound the alarm about the potential effects large-scale deportations could have on their churches. Walter Kim is head of the National Association of Evangelicals. He co-authored the report.
We want churches to grow, and to the extent that the administration's mass deportation policies and congressional support of that would be, in fact, a church decline strategy, removing millions from active membership of churches.
The report bases its findings on three main sources. One is a study estimating immigration status of migrant populations by the advocacy group Forward.us, and data on religious affiliation was pulled from Pew Research Center and the World Christian Database. Bishop Mark Seitz of El Paso, who oversees the Catholic Bishops Committee on Migration, says nearly 1 in 5 U.S. Catholics would be affected by mass deportations.
Catholics represent 61% of all those vulnerable to deportation in the United States. So this is an issue we obviously feel very deeply because they're in a particularly close way members of our Catholic family.
Many Catholic immigrants may be vulnerable to deportation, but many Catholics also backed Trump in November. The divided flock highlights political tensions among American Catholics.
On one hand, you have a big, giant denomination who is going to be profoundly affected by people being renditioned, and I'm going to use the word renditioned, out of this country who are faithful and loyal Catholics. But on the other hand, you have Catholic suburbanites and others who voted for Trump who were like, okay, this is cool.
That's Anthea Butler, a religion professor at the University of Pennsylvania. Ask about the report, White House spokesperson Kush Desai defended the president's immigration policies, saying Trump was, quote, elected with the resounding mandate to secure our borders and mass deport criminal illegal migrants. Desai added that, quote, our immigration laws will be enforced and must be respected. But the Evangelical and Catholic report is just the latest example of growing faith-based pushback to Trump's immigration agenda. Dozens of religious groups have sued the Trump administration over its immigration policies, arguing that they infringe on their rights to minister to migrants and refugees. Several evangelical organizations held a vigil on Capitol Hill in March, condemning the administration's cuts to foreign aid. Myle Green, head of the evangelical group World Relief, says Congress should think twice before funding Trump's push for mass deportation.
And if they're going to do so, they shouldn't profess that they're doing it in the name of Christianity, because those are not consistent with the values of Jesus.
Now Green and other evangelical and Catholic leaders hope they can convince fellow churchgoers that immigration is not just a matter of politics, but a matter of faith. For NPR News, I'm Jack Jenkins.
This story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
How the trade war is making retirement planning harder.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. With the president's party holding both houses of Congress with multiple allies at the Supreme Court, is it me being facetious, or is there an argument that the bond market has become the remaining check on executive power in America? President Trump explained his dramatic turnaround on tariffs on Wednesday as a consequence of people, presumably investors, getting, quote, yippy. That's a golf term when nerves give you the yips on the fairway. Christopher Lowe, chief economist at FHN Financial in New York, has been watching those yippy signals from markets. Morning, Chris.
Grapple with the uncertainty caused by the on-again, off-again U.S. tariffs and some economists' grim predictions of recession. A lower dollar means you'll pay more for imports because it takes more dollars to buy the foreign currency.
Check, the Dow is down 65 points, 0.2%. So is the S&P 500, 0.2%. The NASDAQ is little changed at the moment. Now let's get back to that interview with Christopher Lowe. Good morning.
Good morning, David.
So, I mean, among the signs of yippie behavior, bond yields falling even as stocks were falling in tandem, dollar falling, that was sending a signal.
It was, and we've seen it before. We saw it during the housing crisis. We saw it during the pandemic. Effectively, people have lost so much money in trades, and they're probably levered. They're getting margin calls. We did hear that from British bank regulators. And so they start looking for ways to raise cash. And if you're forced to raise cash, you don't sell the thing that's down 80%. You sell the thing that's actually up in price, that still has value. And so they started selling treasuries.
And then stepping back, I mean, why were they so yippy, financial market players? This is the sense that tariffs cut into profits, cut into consumption, could raise the risk of recession, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. That's where it started. And there's no doubt, right? J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, all warning that global recession was likely, given the level where those tariffs were set. And I think that's really the most important element in this. We all knew we were getting global tariffs on April 2nd. No one expected them to be as high as they were. And as Howard Lutnick explained, the president decided it would give the U.S. a negotiating advantage. And while that might make sense from a negotiating standpoint, it obviously had a devastating impact on financial markets.
Yeah, and at the time, prior to the turnaround on reciprocal tariffs, the president was making statements on social media saying that he's not paying much mind to the market.
As long as it was an equity market sell-off, I think that's probably right. But it's one of those things when you start to see particularly treasuries selling off. Treasuries are the financial foundation of the entire global system. If Treasury yields start rising, if Treasury prices start falling too much, it absolutely disrupts the global economy. If it was possible to escape global recession, well, it's impossible if the Treasury market melts down.
Christopher Lowe, chief economist at FHN Financial, toward the end of a exhausting week, although we have one more trading day here. Chris, thank you.
Thank you, David.
An important interview there. Thanks for your patience with getting that discussion to you. After the Trump administration confirmed yesterday China tariffs are up at 145%, China today put its tariffs on U.S. goods up to 125%, but said it would ignore any further escalation by the United States. Meanwhile, one of the big banks, Morgan Stanley, reported strong profits for last quarter this morning, but raised a warning flag about loan losses and turbulence in financial markets ahead, given tariffs. With worries of recession, the U.S. dollar hit a three-year low today. A euro costs $1.13 this morning.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Viking, exploring the world in comfort. With a fleet of small ships, Viking offers travel experiences for the thinking person. Discover more at viking.com.
Can you mix Prada with Versace, or is that a fashion faux pas? Prada of Italy is buying Versace, also from Bella Italia. Capri Holdings, Versace's parent, is paying $1.4 billion. As a guy who wears Patagonia and L.L. Bean, I hadn't realized that Versace and Prada customers are different. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Think of Prada's clothing as being more minimalist and Versace's as being more maximalist.
Very dynamic color, very unique look, a little bit of that Roman Caligula look.
Milton Pedraza leads the Luxury Institute, a consulting firm. He's done some work for Versace in the past. He says one challenge Versace faces is that its clothes aren't necessarily everyday staples. Versace's revenue dropped by 15% last quarter. And Pedraza says with this acquisition, Prada is getting a well-respected fixer-upper, and one that could put it on a new path, where we see
at least the beginnings of a luxury fashion conglomerate that is Italian-owned and Italian-driven.
But it'll need to find its customers all around the world, says Susan Scafidi, founder of the Fashion Law Institute at Fordham.
The Made in Italy label is key to luxury, but Made in Italy has to sell outside Italy. Italy is a substantial market, but it's not anywhere near as large as the U.S.
And Scafidi says aspirational consumers are a big part of that market. And if tariffs make those colorful Caligula-type pieces more expensive, then they might hold off. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
And a key reading on wholesale inflation came in tame this morning. It's for pre-tariffs March and mostly due to falling crude oil prices. The bond market is down with interest rates up sharply, 4.55%. Stock indicators just kind of sitting there. S&P 500 is down 4 points. Big deal. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.